Would you please state your name, the date, the time, and your location?
Sure. My name is Angelina M. Lopez. The date is October 13th, 2022. It is 2:36 p.m. Central Time, and I am in Houston, Texas.
And do you consent to having this interview recorded, digitally uploaded, and publicly released under a Creative Commons license, attribution, non-commercial, share alike?
I do consent.
Thank you so much for being here with me today. Would you just start by introducing yourself to anyone who might find themselves listening? What would you want them to know about you and the place you're speaking from?
Yeah, my name is Angelina M. Lopez. I am a romance author, kind of a lifelong romance reader and advocate, and I finally published in 2019. My kind of tagline for what I do is that I write sexy books about strong women and the worthy men lucky to love them. They generally are people from Latinx communities is who I write about. They're contemporary romances, very steamy, big books, 100,000 words. If, you know, my editor is lucky, they're only 100,000 words when I turn them in. I debuted in 2019, fall of 2019, which is significant for this conversation. But I debuted 2019. I am now in 2022. My fourth book just released. It's the first book in a new series. Yes, and very excited. Definitely still feeling the effects of the pandemic on my career. And so that is noteworthy. So in the middle of, or just beginning another three-book contract, the first of that book has come out, and it's done really well. I've had a critically successful career that's pretty daunting in terms of its lack of sales. That's been a little bit, and I do think there's a level of pandemic. Everyone says that if you're a new author, that the pandemic has had an effect on that. And so those having both critically acclaimed and sales not great is a difficult place to be, because as my agent says, you're doing everything right. And I said, me doing everything right is part of the problem that if I'm doing everything right, I'm not seeing my sales kind of turn out that way. So yeah, it's a career that looks good, really good on paper. I have starred reviews. I have multiple Entertainment Weekly positive reviews. I was on my local news station recently. So on paper, it looks really, really great. But there is a level of the pandemic affecting, and just societally where we are, affecting it looking better monetarily. So yeah, that's where I am right now. Sexy books, and definitely writing sexy books about people falling in love was a great way to get through a pandemic, without a doubt, to manage through a pandemic. I live in Houston, Texas. I moved here in 2020 during the midst of the, like, beginning of the pandemic. And Houston was, you know, as Houston was losing its mind, I moved from a very, a place that was very conservative in the way it managed its, I was from Northern Virginia, DC area. So it was very, very locked down, very conservative in the way it managed COVID, to Houston, which just almost refused to believe there was. I've moved inside the loop, but I moved here with my husband and my 24-year-old son during COVID, and we've lived in a three-story townhouse, lived. My son was in school while worst days of the pandemic were happening, and we got through it really successfully, partly because the three of us are like innate introverts. I'm a writer. My husband, you know, worked for a global company that was already remote work, and then my son deals with social anxiety disorder, so he returned to university, and that really, you know, was kind of like ideal circumstances for him. So it was an interesting time. I was writing my third book, so interesting time, but I'm in Houston now. I continue to be in Houston, so that's where I am.
Tell me a story about your life during the pandemic.
So we had been I released my book like early November of 2019, and my debut book. And the debut book was notable because it was about a billionaire businesswoman and romance. We have lots of books about these kind of very alpha, you know, almost caveman-like billionaire men. And I had decided I really wanted to write a book about billionaire women, but not just a series about billionaire women, but not just kind of taking your standard male tropes and putting them on a female, but really looking at what does power look like when women wield it. So I really embraced this kind of spin on a trope, and that she was Mexican-American. My heroine was Mexican-American. So I have a self-made Mexican-American billionaire businesswoman that really fundamentally tried to take apart this very popular, the trope that became very popular with 50 Shades of Grey, and really analyze it. So it was sexy. It was, you know, I love romance, so it embraced all of the escapism and bonkers plot lines and really over the top. And yet it was still really looking at women in power and how the world confronts them, how they manage the world. So it was doing all of these things. So again, so critically, it did well. It was a critically acclaimed book, really did well. But, you know, that's November of 2019. I get to do a few live events. I get to do a few in-person book events. COVID hits. My next book is supposed to come out June of 2020. And so we are all of us are suddenly scrambling. We all talk about remembering our last event before COVID hit. And book publishing at that point there were not Zoom events. There were very few people doing online events. Some people were doing kind of Facebook chats, but it was an unused medium. And all of us quickly went to online events and online video presence within our social media, because our access to readers that we were accustomed to was gone. And it felt like there was a void in connection and entertainment that we could fill. So my career quickly went from, you know, live events, which I was an aspiring author for 20 years before I published. My career quickly changed. You know, in that initial spate of COVID, it looked like, okay, bookstores are dead. Bookstores are over. What actually happened is a lot of people embraced their independent bookstores. Those independent bookstores found ways to still be connections, found ways to thrive, and people were reading. Suddenly you had people reading. However, what happened is that they were reading people with backlist, people who were already well known, people who already had multiple books to go to on the shelves, to go to on Amazon, finding the new author, which is who I was hard. Finding the new author of color, who was even more niche in terms of our presence, our marketing, our reach, was even harder. And romance, you still have 72% of readers are still white. And not only that doesn't dictate what they are reading, but we are going through a transition into romance of really trying to embrace BIPOC authors and BIPOC stories representing, you know, let's reflect our real world. Our real world is not this whitewashed world, but for a long time, romance was. And so this transition to get the reader who can read willingly, seek out the 13th century Scott, you know, Celt book and the, you know, modern day blue alien book and the, you know, multi-tentacled lover book still has a problem of seeing a brown author or a brown character on color. That reader can be confronted all these different ways and not have a problem accessing that material, but they can still see a brown author, a brown character on the cover and say, well, I'm not going to understand their story. So we're still dealing with that. And to a certain extent, COVID, you know, again, feeling niche, trying to become more generalized in terms of who is buying my book, Angelina M. Lopez, Latinx characters, it became harder during COVID, especially as a front list author. Front list was affected by the pandemic and by its reach. So you had people reading, indie books were going, but our careers were not helped in this effort to try to get more diversity in romance was not helped by this going on. So anyway, suddenly it's a very, very, you know, virtual process of trying to reach readers, you know, already struggling with all the things we're struggling with. And, so in the midst of my second book coming out, I also was moving to Houston, you know, packing up a home of 14 years that I raised my kids in, moving to Houston with my son and my husband, and then continuing the career from here. And it's been once we were able to start connecting with readers in real life again, it was a huge treat. I mean, it really was. And it did. It wasn't that we were connecting with readers again in real life. We were connecting with other authors again in real life. And that casual connection of sitting in a restaurant or a bar or a room where you're just the free flow of conversation and information, I hadn't realized how much it was lacking. This two-dimensional flatness, it just doesn't provide that conversation. As much as publishers, agents, they've tried to create environments where it feels like you're just hanging out, you're not. You're not just hanging out, because this is not in a natural circumstance. So there was also a real loss in terms of my own kind of career development, because I just didn't have that connection that I had been accustomed to with other authors. So getting back to that, again, whether it's been entirely the best idea or safest all the time, it has been really, really nice to the events. Sometimes they're a mess, sometimes they're not. It's really up to the book proprietor. Yeah, that's a story. That's one story.
Do you remember when you first heard about COVID-19?
It would have been the same time my book was coming out. It would have been fall of 2019. I want to say it would have been November-ish, November, December-ish. And it definitely was like this scary thing happening some other place. It was a scary thing, but it was happening some other place. And there was still, I'm a Gen Xer. I was born in 73. I do think generationally, there is this sense from my generation that somebody else is going to solve this. Not somebody else. The people in authority are going to solve this problem for us. One thing about being in the industry I am is, this idea of BIPOC authors, that wasn't Gen Xers doing that. That was a younger generation and a younger reader that did that for me. There were older authors than I am taking that space, but it was people who were younger and more fed up and less. I think to a certain extent, I grew up in a world being a certain way and just assumed that's the way it had to be. And it was other authors, younger authors, saying, absolutely not. And pointing out to me, what BS it is, this concept that the world is just, that I should not demand people, women who look like me in the books I read or in the content I embrace, that that's the world I grew up in, that I shouldn't demand that. And so to a certain extent, I do feel as, whether it's generational, it's just me, but there is this generational sense that we grew up that the authority in place would take care of it. So there's a pandemic happening. WHO is going to take care of it. UN is going to take care of it. My government's going to take care of it. Even with, I am staunchly anti-Trump supporter. So even looking at what my government was doing at the time COVID was hitting, still believing somebody was going to save me from and us from this becoming what it was. And so I do. And I remember when it was kind of the first COVID case, or one of the first, I think, in Seattle. Just how fundamentally it has been a long, hard process. And I think the pandemic and all of the societal things that have accompanied it and 2015 election and its results have been a long, jarring process, and nobody's going to come save me. And it does affect now how I manage my own career, and continues to affect. I just had a big book come out, and again, critically acclaimed, and I got my Q3 sales numbers, and they're awful. And it's startling to everyone in the process how bad these numbers can be, considering the kind of acclaim I've gotten. And so I have learned something through the pandemic, through, November 2019 and this horrible thing that's happening in China. Nobody's going to save me. And the authority, whether it's my government, my governor, my, publisher, nobody's going to save me. It's going to be up to me doing that, going up to me and going to be up to the collective of people like me, like-minded people who have the same priorities to take care of that.
So the extent that you're comfortable sharing, would you say something about your experiences with health and healthcare infrastructure prior to the pandemic?
Good. You know, we were, I'm wildly blessed. I was a stay-at-home mom before. I was journalist, had the opportunity that once my children were born, I was a freelance writer. But again, it was because of the work my husband was doing that allowed for that. So we were doing well. We were, you know, upper middle class family doing well, had really great health insurance. I remember the feeling like there was a seismic change. Maybe, I don't know, 5-8 years before the pandemic. So 2010, 2011, where suddenly the things that I expected to be effortless by the insurance weren't anymore. And suddenly there were a lot more demands of me as a, you know, I'll be 50 next year. So long span in terms of, you know, healthcare and my perception of it, and a mom. I'm a mom of two kids, so going through it for that. But yeah, I want to feel maybe like 2010, 11, where suddenly the things that were effortless for us to access with healthcare and health insurance started becoming more complicated. And it felt like I hadn't changed anything. You know, we hadn't lowered our, you know, what we were paying. We had, you know, jobs, nothing we had done had changed. And yet services, the ease of access, all of that started changing. And so, you know, it was good in the, under the umbrella of upper middle class family in Washington, D.C. and Northern Virginia, in an area where good healthcare was easy to access, and being able to pay our premiums and overages without any hardship. So relatively good. What's actually been really fascinating is we moved to Inside the Loop Houston, which is this small center, and a mile away from us is a place called the Medical Center, and it is this strip of hospitals and university hospitals, and we have now located ourselves in a 1 mile of some of the best medical care in our country, and we're part of the Houston Methodist. Our insurance allows us to access Houston Methodist system, which is all interconnected, which is, it's kind of like Kaiser in California, where super enmeshed, super, a lot of technology driven apps, it all works together and it doesn't feel limiting. It feels beneficial. I know people were doing Kaiser in Northern Virginia that felt very limiting, very, it wasn't the quality of care. This is phenomenal quality of care. We're first in line for COVID vaccines. Part of being first in line was because so few people were getting COVID vaccines in Houston that they were easy to get. But our healthcare system provided all of this technological instant access. So, you know, the second we could get into them, we could. Our doctors are calling us. It's available. Get in there, you know. So weirdly enough, our specific situation during COVID is actually, our medical care has actually improved just purely location-based and kind of insurance-based. Our insurance hasn't gotten any better or worse. It's simply what our insurance now allows us to access is far superior than what we had before.
What changed for you when lockdown hit?
So I am, by nature, a lot of authors are innate introverts. We are observers who keep to ourselves. And when I say that I'm an introvert, people laugh because I can talk and I enjoy talking and I enjoy making a point when I talk. But what I find is I can go, and I love, my husband and I were that obnoxious foodie, for lack of a better term. We love going to restaurants. We like to sit at the bar and talk to the bartenders about the ingredients you're using. I mean, we're obnoxious, like obnoxious. So I like being out in the world and I like input. You know, I like to see new things and I like to talk to people. But if I go to an event, if I go to, whether it's hanging out with friends or whether it's, you know, an event with people, or especially a reader event, I'll do that. And then I don't want to do anything else for the next 4 days. I don't, even if like a week, like my husband and I like being out, but we'll do one event a weekend and then that's it. Like we don't want to do anything else. And sometimes those weekends where we don't have anything planned, that's delicious. Like we love it. So I am a person who really enjoys sitting at my desk by myself for 8 hours and talking to the characters in my head. You know, I really, it's something, the writing process I fall into effortlessly. Not that writing is easy, but I fall into the process of it. It really does the worries of my day just, and part of it's training. You know, I'm a very disciplined writer. I write every day at the same time, but the world falls away. And so for me, the writing during the pandemic was, and the isolation of the pandemic wasn't difficult. My husband and I will celebrate our 25 year wedding anniversary next year. Yeah. And we innately enjoy each other's company. Like I find him wildly entertaining still, weirdly. But I find him very entertaining. And then our son is just this really fascinating, funny, kind, smart person. And so in terms of like the roommate for my husband and I, he was a perfect roommate. We moved July of 2020. So just, you know, lockdown had just begun. We moved to a 3-story townhome. So my office is on in the guest bedroom on the third floor. My husband's office is in this, we have this massive living space on the first floor. And he's created an office out of the corner. So his office is on the second floor, and my son and his schooling was on his level on the first floor. And so we, you know, our interaction during the day is very limited. We hardly talk to each other. We don't see each other a whole lot because we don't want to. We all go to our corners or went, you know, during pandemic, we would go to our corners, get our work done. And then we would break at like 6, 5:30, sometimes 6. We were in Houston, so it was this beautiful weather. Like, it was actually an okay summer. It wasn't a horrible summer. So we'd break. We would have cocktails. We'd have a deck. We'd sit out and have a patio. We'd have cocktails, or we'd have them inside. We have a long dinner together. We'd sit around an hour and a half. Then our son would go do his work, and we'd go watch TV. And it was a lovely, we'd go take walks around the neighborhood. And we live in a gated townhome complex. And we have 12, it's like, I don't know, 24 townhomes maybe. There's 12 kids who live in it. So we had moved in and we got a flyer on our door. The kids would do performances. So they would do these performances like in the garage, and the parents would bring pizza and beer, and we'd all be outside, you know, staying like potted families away from each other, but getting to know our neighbors. It was like we were living in some idyllic times that I don't actually think ever existed, but this idea of like the kids going outside and playing and just running around and getting to know your neighbors. It happened because of COVID. So for us, for me, I had, you know, looking at the globally, how scary what was happening, how frustrating it was what our government was doing, how unresponsive certain, you know, human beings that seemed completely reasonable, how unresponsive they were being. That was this large umbrella of what was happening. Our, you know, a woman we knew died in like April, maybe early May. We didn't know her well, but it was shocking and horrifying. She's younger than I was and died of COVID. And so there was this umbrella thing happening, but our day to day, and again, I spend 8 hours a day like writing, like people falling in love and having good sex. And so it's like, it was this weird, you know, that mitigate this umbrella stress was mitigated by the day to day love of my career and the enjoyment of my, you know, true, like the best roommates I could have had for a situation like this. We're all innate introverts. And then the joy of moving to a place, we moved to Houston for out of choice. We just were done with the East Coast and done with where we lived, done raising, you know, done with high schools. And so we moved inside the Loop. We walk, there's cocktails and, you know, like cocktail places and top 10 restaurants and coffee shops. I could roll out of my house into there. Everything we wanted out of moving was present, even though we couldn't access it completely during COVID. Chose not to access it completely. We had these great neighbors, super welcoming. The community and the friendship we were looking for was here. So, you know, my day to day was this lovely thing happening, and this lovely, like, the relationship I built with my son and my husband was like a great one. It was this lovely affirmation of this thing that I hoped was happening in my life. You know, I'm doing what I want with my career. I have this great relationship with my husband, my son. We all enjoyed each other's company like adults. It was this lovely affirmation of this thing happening during a global pandemic. So that was the that was the weird conflict. And people, you know, one of the questions during live events, during virtual events, a common question you'll ask about other authors is, how did you get through, you know, or how are you getting through? And people would say, my friends and the Zoom calls with other authors and reading. And I would, you know, it's almost you have to apologize for enjoying your husband, your spouse, and your family. But I did. It was my family that got me through it, and my writing, you know, regardless of its, you know, net sales result. I love these books and I love these characters. And it was a peaceful place to spend a really, you know, jarring time.
I want to invite any specifics about how you were feeling about government response to what was happening.
Oh, God. Just, you know, it just, there's a level of horror that I guess to a certain extent I have become a little numb to. It's a horror that has existed since the second that Trump was elected. We weren't listening to the results in 2016? Yeah. We weren't listening to the results because I couldn't, you know, I couldn't. And a week before, I was on a walk with my friend and I was like, there's no way he's going to get elected. And my girlfriend was like, I don't know. And I was like, I had a girlfriend who covered the Obama White House. I'm an a former journalist. And she was covering the Obama White House for the Wall Street Journal. And I asked her, I was like, are you so excited? So she covered the Obama White House, kind of figuring out whether she was going to stay or not. And I said, you know, you're going to have the opportunity to cover the first female president. Like, how exciting. And she was like, I don't know. And ultimately she decided to change jobs before the election. But, you know, one of the first things, like, you know, I'm so glad you got out. I'm so glad. That would have been such a nightmare to cover the Trump White House. But a week before, I was like, there's no way. And my girlfriend was like, I don't know. And the next day after the election, when he won, I went on a walk with my husband. I'm half Mexican-American. My mom's Caucasian. My dad's full-blooded Mexican, but born in the United States. So I'm half, but, you know, you take a look at me. You know I'm something. People have identified me as Mexican my whole life. I had all my own profiling and all that fun stuff. My last name is Lopez. I kept my maiden name. My husband is white, Lundquist, you know, as American, you know, blonde, but just immensely supportive and immense fan of me. So we went on a walk the next day after the election. And my husband was honestly like, if we need to move, we'll move. If we need to figure out someplace else to live. He was more scared for me than I was. Like, it felt like such a, it was so unprecedented to have somebody who was so violent to my face. A president who was one of the first horrible things he said on the election trail was that people who had a face like me were bad people. And that he got elected after saying things like that was just so jarring and alarming. So the level of horror that built up over the election, then him winning, then the years, you know, to my shock, could still be, you know, get worse during a global pandemic, during a situation that felt like, well, this is what's going to bring us all together, because you cannot argue with a virus. Like, it's a virus. Who ever heard of arguing with the cold? I don't think COVID is a cold, but nobody wanted to ever have an argument with a cold, you know? It's a virus. Who's going to argue with a virus? And for instantly it to be chosen as this situation that to separate us and divide us and to call it, you know, who has acting as if there is somehow some willpower over it or some masculinity over it, you know, that you can, you know, alpha your way over COVID, and that you would honestly consider the unnecessary deaths of so many Americans as viable. Like, that's okay. I'm so ashamed of us. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm 50, you know, I'm going to be 50. I have a responsibility for what happened. My husband's like, nope, we don't. We voted, we supported, we, you know, we did all this stuff. But I do. I feel responsibility for what's happened. I feel a responsibility to my children that this is the, you know, excuse my language, shit that we're leaving them. I, to a certain extent, I'm numbed by it, but I cannot believe that this was okay. And I can't believe this is my neighbor. I can't believe that them being right was more important than keeping Americans alive. Like, I'm horrified. I'm horrified and I'm ashamed. I am. I feel ashamed. I feel I could have done more. I could have done something else. I could have something done different. And I feel like if my generation doesn't feel ownership for this, that's where the problem begins. You know, my generation, baby boomers, we are responsible for this. We should feel ownership. We should feel ashamed for it. And I'm sorry. You know, I am sorry to the future generations that are going to have to clean up what we've done. Yeah, I'm horrified and I'm ashamed is how I feel about it.
What are some of the things you noticed in other people's reactions?
Oh, they just so, I mean, it's so funny. They span the gamut even in our own house. And span the gamut in our house, too, with government should have done more and we're all vaccinated and feel it's ridiculous not to. So span the gamut within that. But, you know, again, like, I think to a certain extent, once we got the second vaccine, if I went into a situation where people were wearing masks, I would be like, I'm wearing a mask. And my husband was so angry that that other people who were making more poor choices was requiring us to feel guilty about masks. And so he would put it on. I mean, my husband is he's a person who, That kind of societal, you know, pressure works on him. Like, in larger, you know, certain ways it should work. So it works on him. But he was so angry that our sacrifices and our making choices and not seeing family and all of the things that we had done, it didn't matter. And we were still being subject to, you know, these maskings and just and fear. When we were doing everything right, you know, that it was the choices of people who were doing things wrong that kept this pandemic going, you know, churning along so intensely in the United States. So he just resented it in a way that I didn't. You know, my son is, you know, liberal to the point of, you know, socialism and let's, you know, rise up and bring it all thing down. And I'm, you know, getting there. There's no doubt, like, so frustrated. And, you know, demoralized to a certain extent, but, you know, so he will still a lot of times, not so much in restaurants and those kind of things, but a lot of times in class, there's a lot of students still wearing masks. So he's still masking you know, they've all got back to full time, but a lot of people are still masking. And he said an interesting thing that for a certain extent, it's a way to manage anxiety because you're covering half your face. And I was like, And he thinks that's a lot of his peers are doing that because there's mental health was so intensely affected at that age. I mean, all of us, but especially in that formative age range, who are dealing with so much social, you know, all of their kind of social growth was completely suspended, that there's so much intense anxiety and depression in that age range that a lot of people are still masking because it helps kind of mitigate some of that. My therapist talked about it causes panic breath, that kind of trapped breathing, but he was like, it feels more comforting to have half your face covered, which I thought was a really interesting point of view. So, you know, my parents live on a vineyard in Russian River Valley in Sonoma County. And so they're on 6 acres. And so they handled it like they were, you know, super, super conservative about their movement. It's about masking. And it's funny when we say the words conservative, but in COVID, it means anyway, they were super, super safe. And yet there's a weird subset, and I've noticed this in my peers' parents, where some people did really well during COVID. They did well financially. They did well kind of personally. They, you know, it's a weird, and it wasn't that difficult for them. Because of a certain socioeconomic place they were in. So there's been other kind of like, there's definitely been this feedback loop. Like we've all been in these homes or we've been in these closed like Zooms. And so we're like all getting kind of, and then there's Twitter, right? So there's like, we're all getting kind of the same, we're in our little feedback loop and we're getting the same information. And we're kind of like, sometimes I think we're kind of verifying the worst aspects of things we believe. And then we go on Twitter and it's just like everything's burning or it's the worst. So that is a weird, yeah, I probably don't want to say too much, but anyway, I think there can be a weird feedback loop. I think, you know, certain people where I had dear friends who went through intense depression, intense, scary depression that came out, that the level of isolation and the level of inability to move about in the world was just intensely damaging. And they are doing much, 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 much better now. But it unearthed something in them that they didn't expect. They have mental health issues in their family, but they never expected it for themselves. And it was surprising, but not surprising, but intense, intense depression. I have another dear friend whose marriage is falling apart, and maybe it wouldn't have, maybe it wouldn't have, but the pressures, not the pressures of COVID, really getting to see their spouse that closely has made it much more difficult for them to stay in that relationship. And they're trying to, but they saw things that friends of theirs had seen for a bit, and they saw them much more clearly. I do have, my mom's family is from Northern California. My dad's family is from Southeast Kansas. It's my Mexican American community. Actually, it's what my latest book is about, but I am third generation Mexican American from a small community in Southeast Kansas. We've now, they're fifth generation. My Mexican family came there in the early 1900s to work on the railroad and settled. And you will find throughout the Midwest, there are all of these multi-generational Mexican-American communities because of the railroad. So this is a community of, you know, very much like pull yourself up by your bootstraps. We're very prideful, very self-made. But Southeast Kansas, they and their neighbors are watching Fox News. And so I have Mexican looking last names, Lopez, you know, Ortega, Hernandez, who are actively voting against their own best interests. They're voting for a Trump White House. They're voting. They're anti-vaccinations there. You know, when their rates of people of color dying in COVID, getting COVID were way worse than non-people of color. It is wild the level how well propaganda works. And my family, some members of my family resulted that. And it's made some of those relationships complicated. You know, as COVID is settling into something we start to live with, there's still these conversations that start. And I'm like, we can't talk about this. We are fundamentally different. And it makes me so sad and angry that you're working against yourself and the people we love. So if this is going to be a relationship, this is not something we can talk about. I don't say all of that. I just try to veer the conversation away. But so that's a really weird and difficult. But again, it kind of feels more of the same. It's a continuation of what happened with the 2016 elections. Yeah. So I think that's the varying. Yeah. You know, we have a neighbor who is, I'm not sure how they, I don't know if they're vaccinated. I know they vote for Trump. And I know that every time I've needed anything, our community is wildly diverse. Our townhome community is wildly diverse. Every time anyone needs anything, this is the first neighbor to come out with the carjack, with the, you know, I'll save your dog, I'll, you know, pick you up if your car's out of gas. This is the neighbor. And they do it with, like, there's no pressure. There's no, they do it with absolute service first mentality and zero expectation of thanks, much less, you know, acclaim or applause. Or they just do it. And that has been the weirdest, weirdest aspect of moving to Texas, that, you know, it's people believe what they believe, and yet it's not just friendly. And again, this is I'm painting with a wide swath, but it's this true innate, a neighbor's a neighbor's a neighbor. And, but a physical neighbor. I remember I was in a small town. I was driving back from seeing my family in Southeast Kansas, and I was in a small town in the middle of nowhere in Texas. My GPS moved me around because of highway construction, and middle of nowhere. And I had to go to the bathroom, and I was a little nervous, quite honestly. You know, I hadn't driven through this country since 2016, and I was a little nervous. So I park at this, I have to go to the bathroom. So I park at this gas station that's just a one-off little, it's not even a chain or anything. And as I'm walking the door, these two huge white guys in full camo, full hats to boots, camo. I don't remember if they were coming out or coming. I think they were coming, walking in with me. And I'm seeing this happening. We all get to the doors. Both guys grab both doors, open them. And the guy on my right goes, "Here you go, ma'am." And I say, "Thank you." And I walk in, and I don't remember the last time anyone in D.C. or Northern Virginia opened a door for me or called me. So it's just the weirdest place to live. It's the weirdest place to live. And that's the, you know, confrontation and joy that I've experienced, you know, being here.
What was it like moving while all of this was going on?
It was so funny. So I had a book that was good. We moved, sold our house, put the house on the market May 1st. And this is in Northern Virginia, so great market. Right inside the Beltway. So like a place you want to own a house. Location, location, location. This is location. So we put our house on the market May 1st, and I'm asking a realtor, "Do you sell homes during a pandemic?" And at that point, he's like, "Maybe, I don't know." We sell it in about a month, which is a lot, which is a bit. It's before the COVID pandemic real estate market took off. This was still during a weird time. But we did, we sold it. And so our move was planned for mid-July. And so I had a book release coming out beginning of June. I had a book due like August 1st, and I had to move. So I had all of these things happening. And so I was like, "Guys, we cannot get COVID. We're all healthy. None of us have long-term health problems. So I was like, you know, and our 20, what was he at the time? 22? 22-year-old was living with us, and our 19-year-old had to come home from school. He was in school in Chicago, had to come home in March and come back with us. And he was miserable, like, and made sure we knew it. He was very unhappy and made sure we all knew how unhappy he was. So, but I was like, guys, I cannot get COVID. I've got so much to do, and I have so many deadlines and we're moving. So the boys were okay. The oldest one was great. But again, like, he deals with a social anxiety disorder. So that was more of the same. The baby was having a rough time of it, but kind of did what he could. Finally, he's so miserable. We're all miserable. My husband's like, let's send him back to Chicago. You know, things were fine. It was like post immediate lockdown. He was like, he wants to go. You're going to be happier. Let's send him back. So we sent him back to Chicago. So that relieved some of that pressure. So it was like, okay, we're not going to get COVID because nobody's doing anything. My son gets him. We're all trying to figure out how do we say goodbye to these friends. And we're doing like these weird, like, social distancing little tiny gatherings, like one person to one person. Everything's Clorox, and we're doing it in the backyard, and everyone's, you know, 10 feet apart. But trying to say goodbye to people, we've lived in that area for 20 years, trying to say goodbye to people, but doing it in a safe way, and I can't get COVID. So that's all going fine, except my son says something about an ex-girlfriend. Friends, he's going to be friends, he's ex-girlfriends. I was like, honey, you can't, like, do anything. And you can't get in a car. And he's like, no, 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 it's going to be fine. They're going to come over. We're sitting in the backyard. Whatever. Okay. And I completely believed and I trust him. And he knew, like, I cannot get COVID. You can't get COVID because I can't get COVID. So I come down one morning, like 5 days before the moving truck shows up. And I see his ex-girlfriend's car in front of our house. I'm like, what's her car doing here? So I go up to his room. He's not in his room. And it's early, like 6 a.m. I go, and we had a finished basement. And I open the door, and then the lights are on. And I go, Gabriel? And he goes, yeah. And I go, is it down there? Yeah. He and his ex-girlfriend are downstairs in the basement. I was like, she has to leave right now. It's so funny because I didn't say any of my friends' names, and I even said they, but I like call out. So I don't know if you can believe that, but anyway, it's probably never gonna know. I feel really bad now. Anyway, I'm still so angry. So I'm like, your friend needs to live really right now. And he has been aware. He came home in 2017. He came home his freshman year of school, and he had an undiagnosed social anxiety disorder. We didn't know. He didn't know. We didn't have the vocabulary, and it has been a long journey in mental health for all of us. And a level of, I just didn't know a lot of how the world worked, and I needed this awareness. Like, I didn't know. And now I do. But part of what's made it work for us is my son is really trying to establish this relationship that this is not his parents and him. We sometimes during crisis moments for him, we that relationship is established again. But for the most part, we are a support system for him as he's still getting to the things he wants to do. And we've, you know, this many years now, we've really established a good balance. And part of what's made that work is this understanding that we're roommates and that there's a mutual respect, not only from him to us, which he really manages it really well, but for us to him. He is an adult, and there has to be a level of mutual respect for this to have worked as well as it was. But in that moment, we totally went from mom to son, no mutual respect on either end. I was furious, and he was like, this is what I needed. Like, I have been good. I've done everything right for COVID. I'm not sorry. The day before the moving truck shows up, he comes, and I'm doing something in our study. It's where I worked. And he comes in the doorway, and he's 6'2". So he's a tall kid. I'm 5'3". He's a tall kid. And he's standing in the doorway, and he's just, he looks like he got hit. He looks like he got slapped. He's white, pale. His eyes are huge. He's just standing. He goes, "Mom, I'm so sorry. I have a fever." And I'm just like, great. So we immediately, what do we do? He had a fever, like 102 fever. We immediately gathered, and that was like, testing was like in these outdoor, it was all over the place, but we could get an appointment for the next day for testing for all three of us. Literally, it was like an hour before the moving truck was supposed to show up. We could get the test done. I'm like, all of us were dealing with like uncharted water. So go and get the test. And I want to say it was a rapid test. I want to say we got the results relatively quickly. Who knows? It wasn't COVID. He did not have COVID. I did not. None of us had COVID, at least from that initial test. So then they're like, come back in, because he was obviously, and he said he would have had lesions. He had had mono like the year before. It wasn't mono. It wasn't, to this day, we don't know what it was. He got so sick. He was so sick. What we ended up doing is I ended up getting a motel room, because I didn't want, regardless, I didn't want to have to tell every mover that walking in, it's not COVID. We got in the hotel room. Put him there with the dog, like a block away. You know, we're dealing with this. So anyway, moving to Houston was, we were going to drive because we had the car and the dog. Gabriel was going to help. We were driving this Prius. So it's three, which wasn't going to be an issue if he was driving, but it's three people, grown adults, two of them at 6 foot and 6'2", and the dog in a Prius, and one of them sick, like, we just like made a bed out of like the front seat, and just like, he was so sick, so miserable. It wasn't strep. To this day, like, we kept testing him for different things in it. And by the time he had like, I don't know, maybe he was sick like 4 or 5 days here, all of those days without any furniture. We have like air mattresses on the floor. He's still sick. We get here, but like going that trip was, I don't know, two nights. We did it in two nights or three nights. That was just a blur, because we're changing our lives. We're trying not to stop at anywhere, but we had read that rest stops get cleaned. We're getting cleaned more than gas stations. So we're only stopping at rest stops for bathrooms. I would like load up a cooler at the beginning of the day with like waters and like foods and stuff like that. And then we'd drive. We would, you know, manage checking in at hotels in like Alabama. Like, it was all of this insane, but it was such a blur, because changing our lives, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and our kid is like so sick, like, but we never got sick, and we don't know what it was, but it was, we can now laugh at that story, because my son just, he was, you know, later he was just like, I couldn't believe it. And I was like, and you learned to listen to your mommy. And he of course won't concede that whatsoever. Like, no, it's not what I learned, but it was, he was mortified. He was horrified. Like, it was a very funny, very funny moment. So yeah, that's how the move was. It was an ordeal.
What are some of the things that you noticed that were different in your two sons' reactions to the pandemic?
Again, I think that our son's mental health, you know, him being isolated was kind of the norm we'd been dealing with for a couple of years before. Really doing a lot. He went to our local junior college he was going to Rice University, and he's back at Rice University, but came home from Rice University. And so he was in therapy on meds. And part of the therapeutic process was going back to school. And going, even at the community college level, those courses don't transfer to Rice, but it was incredibly important for him to go through the process of that. So he'd been in school, he had friends, he had a couple of girlfriends, but there was still a lot of a journey, a lot of work, you know, mental health work for him to get back. He wants to be a physicist, so it's, you know, getting back to where he wants to be. To a certain extent with our son Gabriel, there wasn't, you know, I think part of his reaction was me very, very beginning. And again, it was for myself. It was for my husband. There are huge momentous things happening in the next 3 months and we cannot risk those. Once we moved here to Houston, my husband, my son, and I were very aligned in how we were just doing everything. So there never really wasn't any conflict after that. My younger son was 18 years old, had moved from Northern Virginia to go to film school in Chicago, downtown Chicago. You know, he had these kids had, they were like these full apartments. The dorms were built like communal room and then their own bedrooms and then two separate baths, like their own bedrooms. And two of the kids would share one bath and two kids would share. So it's like the most like sumptuous kind of arrangement you could have as a freshman in college. Like I would just tell him like, you're spoiled rotten. Like, and it was a joke only because he was paying for, not he, but his scholarships were paying for most of his schooling, but I was like, still spoiled rotten. So this kid is in film school in downtown Chicago, like everything he wants, having to come home. I mean, he was doing everything. Like when it hit, I was like, do you want to come back? He's like, they're not closing the dorms yet. I'm going to ride it out as long as I can. And then he was looking to see if he could live with a friend. Like, he was doing everything in his power to not come home. And ultimately, like I said, you have to get out. He didn't have an arrangement. He didn't have a job, you know, jobs are impossible. It's kind of, you got to come home. He was miserable. He kind of put all of his energy into, he made his first album. He released his first album. Like, he really got into music. He'd already been getting more into music. We got into music during that time. He would take a skateboard and just leave for the day, just go riding for the day. And I had to trust that he wasn't like making out with people, you know, like, you know, and trying to stay 6 feet back. And, you know, again, we did not get COVID. Nobody in our household got COVID until this summer. And it was me first. And I had it this is after my boot, like not like I had gotten one booster. I got it. And then 2 weeks later, my son got it. He was actually sicker than I was. My husband still has never gotten it. So we did not get it until summer of 2022. Yeah. It's like May, I think would have been May. My husband is this weird, like total anomaly. He's never gotten it. But it was really hard on my son. And even when he talks about going back to Chicago, my baby is an extrovert and family of introverts. And that was a huge part of kind of a growing pain for him, his senior year, his freshman year, and a lot of anger towards me and his dad. And, you know, I took about 6 months of like, okay, like, I'll take it. Let's talk through it. Let's go through it. And at the 6 month point when I was still getting yelled at, I was like, I'm done being yelled at. Like, we're good. I've listened. We've changed what we can. I said, you know, but one of the things we really came down to is, honey, I understand the sense that you feel like maybe you're doing it wrong, you know, but you're not. You literally are. You feed off interaction with other people. That is a basic nutritive source for you. It is not for dad and me and your brother. But if you're sitting at, we were a dinner table family. We sat at the dinner table every night. I said, if you're sitting at a dinner table and you see three people who you love going about things, you know, and needing things differently than you do, then one of those assumptions could be, well, I must be doing it wrong. I was like, you're not. But you have different needs than we do. And we want to make sure that any sense that you have that, if we're giving out the sense that you're doing it wrong, we don't want that. But we also want you to leave space that we're not doing it wrong either, that we just have different ways. So I think coming to that understanding, to a certain extent, the pandemic helped us figure that out. Because we had, three of us had really aligned, seemingly, in the needs we had. And Simon, our baby, just had very different needs. And we've definitely come to like, I think that we've come to a real place of peace, in kind of that we're different and that's okay. And, but what I remember, he really, when COVID really started to recede, he was over the moon. He was over the moon. He actually just hosted an event. So he's really in the music scene and he just hosted an event in Chicago that he put the money down for. He rented the space, whatever, and he made this huge profit. And so he's 21, he'll be 22 this summer. So he's like, yeah, he needs people. He needs interaction. He needs, collaboration is again a source that feeds him. And so very different ways about approaching something like that expects you to be isolated.
What's it been like living with a dog during all this?
He's this old. Our son and our dog both are. No, I'm not going to do that. Our dog is not hugely social. He's just not hugely social. And he was a rescue. He's 3.5 years old. And we thought we were going to get a dog and we're going to go camping. We're going to hang out at the coffee shop. He's going to get us out in the world. He's a walk dog and he's a great house dog. I mean, great house dog to the point like we could have 50 people parties with like infants running around. And my dog would just be so like not bother anybody. Like he'd be engaged, like involved, like, present, but like he never jumps. He didn't bark at people. He'd have little infants like, you know, pulling his tail and he would just sit there and take it. Like, I mean, we wouldn't put him through it much, but just this incredibly, just the best house dog. He didn't, you know, he just doesn't do anything wrong in the house. But taking him on walks, if he sees another dog, he barks and he's got this big, deep chest. And, you know, we spent about 2 years once we got him. Again, he was 3.5 and a rescue. Spent 2 years trying to figure it out. And we finally had a vet. It was like, love the things that are good about him. This is not going to change. Just stop trying to take him to dog parks. And to a certain extent, that gave us like permission to like, okay, we can just love the dog that he is. So we take him on a daily walk. If he sees a dog, he's worse with my husband. He'll listen to me more. But if he sees a dog, he barks super loud. I pretty much ignore the people. I just manage him. He's not lunging. He's not aggressive. It's just this super loud, very noticeable bark. So really very little change because especially when we moved to Houston, like when our friends were complaining in 2022 as fall hit and suddenly everyone had to go back inside and they couldn't, our DC friends, our, you know, north of the country friends were complaining about going inside. One of my girlfriends was like, I haven't seen people in 5 months because we can't get out. You know, it's 82 degrees here. Like we were going on walks. And so, it was really easy for us with him because my husband and I take turns every morning giving him a big long walk. We just kept doing that. So it was really effortless, but it did. It was like kind of the fourth person in our, you know, little COVID clubhouse was this dog. And to a certain extent, we were like, you know, this dog, if Peter had to go back to work, if my husband went back to an office, I don't know what our dog would do with himself. He's so accustomed to, I mean, he must love the pandemic. Like it must be the best thing ever because we're home all the time. We're with him all the time. And he always has one of us in sight. If I'm on a call because I'll have maybe 2 meetings a week. I close my door so it doesn't disturb my husband. But if not, he's either here in the hallway staring at me or he's downstairs in the living room in front of my husband's office staring at my husband. Like he's always got like line of sight on one of us. And I don't know what he would do if we went back to work in an office. He's 16, so we're probably not going to have to know. But yeah, he's loved it. Pandemic's the best thing that ever happened to him.
You'd mentioned getting vaccinated. Could you tell me a bit about the decision to do that and then what access was like once you decided to do so?
Sure. My husband is 4 years older than I am. So he was naturally, his age put him, he got his annual and we got his annual and it was, you know, we'd been here not a full year yet. But we hadn't needed, you know, that's telling. We moved here in July and nobody had needed a doctor. My son was seeing a therapist and actually he was still medical he was still meeting with his therapist and psychiatrist in Northern Virginia because they were doing it all, you know, I forgot what that was called, teledoc. They were doing it all teledoc, which would not have happened without the pandemic. If the pandemic hadn't happened, he would not have been able to stay with him. He would have had to find somebody right away. So that was delayed. So he was the only one who was seeing a medical professional at all. My husband or I didn't need one. And then I think he actually signed up for his annual or made an appointment in order to get the vaccine. So his annual was like March of 2021. And he was in an age, something, I can't remember exactly, but he was of an age where it was like, okay, he was immediate. Well, when I found out that, I was like, oh, then I'm getting my annual and see it, like, I'll beg. I don't care. Cause I wasn't old enough. But when I went in, like my weight was, like I got the lovely COVID weight and he was like, okay, you can get it. I'm like, yay, it was worth it. The weight was worth